This summer, your local movie theater will become a tent revival for proclaiming Jesus, and you're invited to be a part of this unique evangelistic campaign. Join with believers nationwide for the Million Souls Campaign to bring unsaved family and friends to watch the powerful new movie, The Firing Squad, starring Kevin Sorbo and Cuba Gooding Jr. The Firing Squad tells the incredible true story about prisoners who find faith in the face of execution and transform their prison in the process. As the movie ends, co-star Kevin Sorbo comes on the screen to lead the entire theater in a prayer to commit one's life to Jesus Christ, providing an on-site opportunity to introduce family and friends to the message of Jesus. Go to firingsquadfilm.com and learn how you can receive free tickets and more to The Firing Squad and participate in this unique theater event. Bring your friends and your family and bring your faith. That's firingsquadfilm.com to learn more.
What would you call today's show? I mean, it kind of turned into a really weird...
Yes, well, that's a great term for it. It was really a weird experience, a roller coaster ride, but a fun one
most of the time. What were we talking about in hour number one of the podcast? Octopus murder, which kind of takes you into this place because tomorrow's podcast is about the octopus murders, and I have the actual journalist who I think is nuts for doing it, and the filmmaker... And we were talking about this, and if you don't know what the Octopus Murders is, it's on Netflix. Watch it, and then watch tomorrow's podcast that comes out. I don't know what to think. I really don't know what to believe, what not to believe. And it's this crazy 50-year-old, 40-year-old story that's still going on today. And people have been killed because of it.
And we can fill your entire Netflix queue for 3 months with just that 1 hour of programming today, because there's lots of great shows to mention.
And then the second hour, we had a guy on. His name is Ashton Forbes. He's an investigative journalist. Stu thinks this is absolutely nuts. Mm-hmm. I think it's most likely not true, but I don't know. I don't know. I mean, every time you say, that'd never happen, they're locking America down.
Right.
You know what I mean? This is the mysterious disappearance of Malaysia Flight 370. Do we have a weapon or a device that can now make wormholes? I know this sounds nuts, but wait until you listen to it, and especially if you watch the podcast. And then hour three, we have Cliff Sims on, who was at the White House. He tells us crazy stories about the CIA and everything else. All the way down to robot dogs with flamethrowers strapped to their back that you can buy. It's crazy. The Friday episode begins in a minute. Mother's Day is fast upon us, and I want to talk about Preborn, maybe the organization out there who cares about moms the most. Preborn offers expecting moms free ultrasounds. When a young mother who's in distress about her pregnancy comes in, those ultrasounds can change the chances that she will choose life. But Preborn doesn't stop there. They also offer love and care to that mom. They don't just abandon her the moment after she gives birth. That's what the left always accuses us of. But Preborn goes on to help that mother out for 2 years afterward, showing her and the baby God's love and our love. This Mother's Day, why not help bring life to both mom and her baby? One ultrasound is $28. If you're a business owner, perhaps you consider a larger donation for a write-off, because we know the government isn't saving babies. A donation of $1,000, $2,000, or even $20,000 would save so many lives. All gifts are tax deductible. Reaches right into eternity. Dial #250. Say the keyword baby. That's #250, keyword baby. Or go to preborn.com/Beck. That's preborn.com/Beck. Sponsored by Preborn.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Did you see the octopus murders?
I did not.
Do you know anything about them?
Yes, I do.
What do you know?
You told me I should watch the series. Officially on my list of series to watch.
Oh, like, I've got one of those too.
Yeah.
I've got a list.
It's long.
Yeah, my list is like, when did I want to watch that?
Right. Some of them I don't even remember what they were.
I don't either.
Ended in like 2009.
Yeah, I know.
I haven't watched them yet.
Yeah.
But it is on the list. It is on the list. It sounds really interesting.
You should move it up on the list. It's one of these things that you really don't have any idea whether what is being investigated is real or not. And the more they go, the more you're like, this all sounds so plausible. This is, I mean, and it's deep, deep, deep corruption in our government. Mm. And it's about a guy who, I don't even know, 20 years ago was investigating, back in the 1980s, so even farther than that. He was investigating, what was it called? It was during the Reagan administration, and there was this new software that was being developed, and the Justice Department got involved. And it was this software that could help, what is it called? Promise, yeah. The Promise software. And I remember these stories at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a software that investigators could put things into the computer and say, oh, we're working on this case, and this is what happened in court. And it would collate everything. So if you're working on a case at the FBI, you could type in, you know, the people involved and everything else, and it would pull all of the information in to one source, and you'd be going, oh, well, Fred's working on the same kind of thing, too. And you could coordinate throughout the whole country.
Seems pretty basic.
Right.
Important.
Right. And so the company that was creating this, it was just gangbusters, okay? And then the government got involved and said, we want you to build this for the government. And the government got involved and promised this company all kinds of money and everything else. They developed it, and then the government didn't pay the bill and said, yeah, we're not going to use this. And that put the company out of business. And they were like, wait, we just did all this stuff for you. Yeah, we're not going to use it. Put them out of business after somebody approached them and said, I think you want to sell your business to me. And they were like, no, we don't. I think you're not hearing me. You want to sell your business to me. Understand? And they said, nope. Next thing they know, government doesn't, and they're wiped out. About a year later, the software shows up in Canada. And it's being used by Canada and their, I believe it was their spy agencies, okay, under a different name. What happened, they think, is that the United States used this, brought this into Intel and everything else, then gave it to our allies, and then started selling it to our enemies as well, but not from us, okay? It was no longer the Promise system. It's the same system, but not named Promise.
The Promise, yeah.
And what they had in it was a back door. So now the agencies on both our enemy list and our friends, we were spying on them. And we could know exactly what they were working on, who they were tying. I mean, all of this stuff. It's
pretty smart.
Pretty smart.
Yeah.
Pretty smart.
Mm.
Except that's when the murders started.
Oh, okay. Okay. There's always an asterisk with the
right.
U.S. government.
And it just starts to spiral out of control. And this guy, he's a journalist, and he starts seeing this, and he's starting to put it together. And it is an octopus. It is one of those things that you're like, wait. And as he started to learn what was going on, every bit of it sounds like, yes, that's what our government would do. It goes into the arms for, you know, the hostages for arms. What was it? The
Iran-Contra.
Mm-hmm. It goes into that. It ties that kind of in. Shows that the arms were made or packaged by the U.S. government, but they went to an Indian reservation where the native territory outside of the United States, but right inside the United States, showed how they built this casino, laundered all kinds of money, killing people there. I mean, it's crazy. So this guy, he says he has one more piece. And he's told all along, he gets phone calls and he's like,
I don't think you want to ask these questions. It's not going to be good. Don't keep asking questions.
So he's got one more question, and that's the one that everybody's like,
I'm telling you, don't ask that question.
He gets a guy that says, I'll tell you this piece of information, meet me here in this small town on this day, and we'll talk. He goes. He tells his brother before, if something happens to me, it's not an accident. Okay? He goes. He commits suicide in his hotel room. He cuts his wrists so deeply that he cuts the tendons.
Ah.
Okay? Now, that would explain one cut on one wrist. But if you do that on one wrist, how do you then use your hand to do it on the other wrist?
Right,
okay?
Right.
He cut himself like 12 times deeply, so deeply, the hands didn't...
All right.
And then there's like bloody prints all over the walls and stuff, and you're like, this doesn't seem like a suicide.
Right.
Okay? Everybody walked in and said, whoa, something bad happened here. But then, all of a sudden, police walk in. Oh, yeah, we're investigating. This looks like it could be a murder. Nope, definitely not a murder. This is suicide. We don't even need to look into it. So the journalist dies. Years later, another journalist, he reads about this guy, and he's like, I wonder what that was all about. Okay? And he picks the thing up. And he's now talking to this is where the documentary picks up. He's now talking to the same people who are like, you don't want to ask those questions. Okay? He ties this whole thing together. All of the same people, some of the really spooky people that were clearly with the government are dead now, or at least thought to be dead. I asked them in the interview today that you can find on Blaze TV. Do you believe they're dead? Like, nope. And there were several things that I asked them, and they're like, nah, we're not gonna go there. We're not gonna talk about that. Do you know something? Not saying I do, not saying I don't. We're not talking about that. It's fascinating.
Mm.
And how deep does this thing go? You're left watching this documentary, honestly, not knowing what to believe. You're watching and you're like, I think this is real, but everybody, and because they talk about it, conspiracy theories, when there's a conspiracy, the government will set up people that will tell you half truths and the other half is nonsense. So you blur the lines on everything. So you're not sure what's true and what's not. It's a view into how our government really works like you've never seen before.
Mm. And it's on Netflix.
It's on Netflix, called The Octopus Murders.
Looks like four parts.
Yeah.
Four-part documentary.
Yeah. And let me see. Do we have time? Yeah. Where are the cuts? I don't have the cuts. Which ones are the cuts of this?
All right, you want to take a quick break?
Okay,
and we'll come back.
No. Here it is. The Scariest Person You Met, cut 7. Listen to this. Now, this is the filmmaker, or the journalist and the filmmaker. They've been best friends since they were kids. The filmmaker came to the journalist at one point and said, dude, intervention. You got to stop. You got to stop. And he said, at one point, I realized my friend wasn't going to stop, and I was concerned about him. And so I got into it with him and just said, okay, let me hear it all. He said, and I was like, I think you might be right. And so he got into it with him, both knowing they could die. Listen to this. You guys talked to some scary people. This guy chilled me to the bone.
Yeah.
He seemed like, he just seemed very confident that things happen and nobody's going to question me. And okay, maybe I've killed people. Maybe he had that air about him of stone cold killer in a business suit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that what you guys?
I'm like, which door is he going to come out of?
Because
he may or may not still be alive.
Do you believe he is?
I think he might still be alive.
There's a chance.
I think he would be 80, right? Yeah, he'd be 80.
So but he's still spooky at 80 if he's alive. He's still spooky.
Yeah,
that guy, was he the, who's the scariest person that you encountered?
Well, okay. Bob allegedly died in 2009?
Yeah.
So in we didn't meet him, but we have a lot of documents and things like that.
We met him. I saw enough.
We talked to a lot of people who did know him. And Sherry, when, you know, who we interviewed, has an amazing story about going to his apartment, which I think is you know.
Tell the story.
Yeah. So Sherry Seymour investigated mainly the West Coast portion of the octopus or this this story, this Danny story. And she started working on it about 3 months after Danny died, and she was calling all of his sources, much like Christian did. But this is in 1991 and 1992. And Robert Booth Nichols is a guy who Danny talked to extensively on the phone and met in person and was, you know, I would say a suspect in Danny's death. And at least for us. And so she went over to his apartment to ask him about these things. And amazingly, he agreed, and he was there with his wife. And at the end of that meeting, he shows her this tape, puts on this tape, which I think they were talking about sort of the manipulability of reality and what and perception and in the media and things like that. And it's the Zapruder film, the JFK assassination film. And he is playing it, and then it's not the one that you've seen before. The driver turns around and shoots JFK in the head. And then she's like, wait, what? And this is 1992 when the Zapruder film isn't, you couldn't just like go on the internet and watch it immediately, you know?
Right. And it wasn't easy to make fake films.
And then he shows her another tape, and that tape, he says, is the one that everybody's seen on the media. And he pauses it, and there's a half of a tree missing. And he says, this is the one everybody's seen has actually been manipulated. I showed you the real one.
And this is before the internet and CGI. And what his point was, just to confuse her, and because she would later go back to her friends and say, no, I saw it. There's a tree missing. When you have the internet, there's no tree missing. There's no tree missing. So both of those were fake. She sounded like a lunatic because both were fake that she saw him or that she saw with him.
Huh.
It's an incredible. They show the whole scene. It's amazing.
Now, what's let me ask you this. What's the spoiler level of this? Like, if I haven't watched the series yet, do I want to watch the series, then watch this interview? Do I want to do it? What's your...
I think you could listen to the interview and find out, you know, stuff and understand it. I think it's better if you listen to... I intentionally did not... It's a three-hour documentary. It's in three nights, okay? We watched in three nights. Three or four. And... you really don't know what turn is next. You really have no idea. I went in and I made the choice. This is for people who have watched it. So I don't explain. We don't go through the whole thing.
Right. Okay.
Okay? Mm-hmm. We just go into the things. If you've watched it, or you could listen to this and you will be fascinated by it. Right. And you'll want to watch it.
You want to watch it. Yeah.
But I don't think there's any spoiler. There's just too much to cover.
Mm.
That you just, it's remarkable. It's called The Octopus Murders, and it's on Netflix. And the interview with the really brave journalist, almost borderline crazy, so brave, and his best friend filmmaker, the interview is available now, came out last night for Blaze TV subscribers, and will be available on tomorrow, on Saturday, wherever you get your podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Well, the day has finally come to a close. As you ease yourself down into bed, stare up at the ceiling, thinking about what tomorrow's going to bring, is the answer pain? If you're living with pain, I may have an answer for you. Now, this is not a pain reliever per se. It's not something that you take like, ow, I got a headache. This is a daily supplement that helps your body fight pain by fighting inflammation, and it's 100% drug-free. Over a million people have tried Relief Factor's Quick Start Kit. 70% of them have gone on to order it again and again, and it helps reduce or eliminate the everyday aches and pains that you're experiencing. Relief Factor can help you feel better. See how Relief Factor can help you with their three-week Quick Start. It's only $19.95, comes with Relief Factor's Feel Better or Your Money Back Guarantee. So why not give it a try? Visit ReliefFactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF. When you feel the difference, you know it works. Now, back to the podcast. Ashton Forbes, investigative journalist. How are you, sir?
Hey, Glenn. Good to be here, man. How are you doing?
Very good. So is it safe to say, I don't even know how to approach this. I really respect your intellect. You seem to know enough about science that you can pull this off with credibility. But at some point, did even you say, this can't be?
Oh, yeah, every single day. So you know, I'm not really a conspiracy guy. I wouldn't say I'm a UFO guy. I'm just a normal guy. This whole investigation started with probably the two most incredible videos in the history of man. You have to be your own harshest critic when you are dealing with something that is this beyond the paradigm. But if you go to the Sherlock Holmes quote, is once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. So I've heard that you're skeptical related to this, and I'm sure a lot of people listening are. I don't blame them at all. So what I want to do with you here today is I want to deconstruct the lie. I want to talk about what really happened with MH370. And then I want to talk about the leaker and the science of what it means for us as a civilization.
Okay.
Well, so the first thing I want to ask you, Glenn, and everybody else is out there, is what do you think happened to MH370? You know, and based on what evidence is the strongest evidence in your mind, based on what you've heard from the media, what have you? And then the last question is, you know, how does a plane crash into the ocean without leaving a debris field? So, and I don't mean this to put you on the spot, but I just want to understand how regular people think about it. Yeah.
Quite honestly, I didn't pay that much attention to it because I was concerned about other things. But here's my recollection of it. It took off. There was some sort of trouble. It kind of took like a left-hand turn for some reason. They followed it for a while, and then it just kind of went into the drink, they thought. And I thought that they had found some debris washing up on maybe the African shore, or I can't remember.
Yeah, no, that's good. And so what a lot of people think out there is that this was some kind of suicidal pilot who took the plane to the middle of nowhere and somehow landed it softly in the ocean for some inexplicable reason that you don't do during a suicidal route. And what I want to tell those people is that this narrative out there is a complete fiction. We searched along the seventh arc, which is where we have these satellite pings, where supposedly we know exactly along this arc where the plane crashed. And we didn't find a single thing. We found no black boxes. We didn't find a single piece of debris. There is about 1,500 pounds of foam on the seats of these planes that should have been floating. And we found absolutely nothing at all. The suicide narrative, I call it the myth, has been completely debunked. This guy was supported by his family, his coworkers, all the officials. The officials have ruled out him being involved. It's not even technically possible, I don't think, to necessarily turn off all the APUs, the power generators, within the 64 seconds from the last communication. People think that he had some kind of route that he planned out there. The FBI looked at it. It was actually just MH150 to Jeddah from Kuala Lumpur. And if you look at the flight path, it's exactly the same as what that flight path is. He was actually slated to fly that on February 4th, and the simulation data is from February 2nd. So clearly he was just practicing that route out there. We know beyond any shadow of a doubt that the United States government knows what happened to this plane. And the way we know that is because they have something called SBIRS, Space-Based Infrared System, by Lockheed Martin. We never forget who we're working for. That's their real slogan. It's always scanning the Earth all the time with geostationary satellites, and they've now incorporated mid-Earth orbit and low-Earth orbit satellites into it. It can produce a Google Earth 3D video playback capability that actually integrates real Google Earth, as well as software called Quick Terrain Modeler. And it's used ground-based computer systems to pull data from these satellites where someone can just log in, pull up location, and track objects. Now, its official purpose is for tracking missiles, but not a lot of missiles that get shot up all the time. So you can imagine how very easily it could be used to track boats, planes, et cetera.
Okay, so what is this called again?
Space-Based Infrared System, SBIRS. So if you Google it, you can find a video of it out there on Lockheed Martin's YouTube channel. When you look at it, you can see that these satellites are scanning the whole world all the time, persistent. It's global persistent infrared surveillance. That's the very first words in the video itself. And there's no way that this system wouldn't have caught a rogue 777 flying for 8 hours, as well as the SOSA system, which is the sound surveillance system. This is a hydrophone system. This is the one that actually heard the Titan sub implode off the Titanic last year. And if it can hear a tiny sub implode, then there's no chance it wouldn't hear a 777 crashing in the ocean. Diego Garcia and Western Australia have hydrophones that should have heard this crash, and they should have been able to pinpoint it just like they did the Titan sub. We know the Navy has no problem lying about it because they lied about the Titan sub for 5 days while all the mainstream media news stations saying, how much oxygen do they have left? And then we also found out about radar. People don't even realize that radar systems are not limited to line of sight. They actually have something called over-the-horizon radar, which bounces off the ionosphere and can see for thousands of miles. So not only is the Jindalee operational radar network from Australia have this, but also most likely, without almost any doubt, the Diego Garcia military base in the Indian Ocean, as well as the Pine Gap American base in Australia, all three of these systems should have had radar capability to track the plane from takeoff to wherever it supposedly landed in the South Indian Ocean. In addition to that, we found spy satellite USA 229. It's a naval ocean surveillance satellite that's run by the Navy. Has a sister satellite right next to it, capable of potentially taking 3D stereoscopic imagery using their sensors, that was right in the Malacca Straits at 1840 UTC on March 7, 2014, staring right down at the coordinates that we see in the MH370 satellite video. Now, in addition to that, you asked, and the one thing I want to say first is that the Malaysian Minister of Defense as well, he says in an interview 7 weeks later after the plane disappears that they knew the plane was not hostile. And that's why they didn't send up jets to track the plane. And you ask yourself, how could you know that a rogue 777 with no communications is not hostile? You couldn't. They must have had communications with the plane. So this begs the question, were communications classified from us that they didn't want to release because they would give up what really occurred on this plane? The last thing I want to say is the debris. Actually, the story that I'm putting forth is the only one consistent with the debris washing up in Africa. It's actually impossible for almost all of the debris to have washed up in Africa from the supposed crash site off the coast of Australia. No one seemed to piece this together, but it couldn't have gone to Russia. It couldn't have been shot down on the South China Sea if that's the case. And even that crash site down there, the very first debris drift models they put together, they threw some boards in the water, immediately found out it was impossible for the debris to have even gotten to the Reunion Island, let alone to South Africa. So then they get a flapper on from the United States and they say, okay, let's throw this in the water. And then they go, yep, okay, this is good enough. It'll get to the Reunion Island. But they don't realize that they have the flapper on sticking out of the water, but the part that's sticking out of the water has barnacles all over it, which means that had to be submerged, which means that, and they need that because they need the wind to blow on it so that it would drift to that location. In addition to that, they look at those barnacles and they find out that the barnacles only have 4 months of growth on them, as opposed to the 16 months since the plane disappeared. 4 months is not enough time for that thing to have drifted 2,000 miles. And if you look at the CNN list of what the debris is out there, you'll find a piece of engine cowling is listed on there, which clearly has an RR of Rolls Royce. It's pretty clearly a 777 engine cowling. This shows up in South Africa, 3,000 miles away, literally impossible for it to have floated all the way from the supposed crash site. And if you look at the currents in that area down there in South Indian Ocean, they actually go to the east. It should, the debris, if this plane crashes somewhere down there, the debris should have washed up all over Australia. So we can conclusively say that there is essentially no way that this plane could have, A, crashed down there in the South Indian Ocean, and B, we know with the United States that they must know what happened to the plane.
Okay, so let me ask you this. If this were happening in real time, the first thing, because it's going off path and it's off path for 8 hours, you would say that jets would be scrambled. It was a hostile because, I mean, that's logical to think. If they thought this guy was on a suicide path or a suicide mission, at least the defense of the world in all countries would do everything they can to lock on to that. So that gives credence to the sound, the hydrophonic sound being activated, the infrared, the satellites, everything would have been just routinely locked onto a rogue 777. Do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And especially because people are afraid that they're going to go fly into the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur.
Correct.
You know? So, I mean, this is like a post 9/11 world we're talking about here. So the other thing, too, is that if that plane didn't crash in the South Indian Ocean, it begs the question, were those satellite pings correct or not? And if those satellite pings were not correct or misinterpreted or something, now this plane could really be anywhere out there. But here's the problem. People say, well, the ocean's really big. You know, maybe it went somewhere else. The problem is the official narrative has it running out of fuel. And they say that these satellite pings indicate exactly where it ran out of fuel, and that's where the plane should be. If those satellite pings are incorrect, then you throw out all the pilot suicide narrative. You throw out everything up to where this plane turned into the South Indian Ocean, and that's in the Nicobar Islands. And it turns out we have two videos, and one of those is called Satellite Video Airliner and UFOs. And in the bottom left of that video, it has coordinates. It says NROL-22. That's the first launch of the SBIRS system in 2006. Right next to it has coordinates that are accurate to 6 decimal places that shift when the perspective changes. We're able to graph that out. That location is the Nicobar Islands. That location is the exact location where they say this plane turned into the South Indian Ocean. Now, one more thing I want to say, just to conclusively prove this plane didn't crash in the South Indian Ocean. 19 family members signed a joint statement saying that the phones were still ringing for up to 4 days. One of them even proved it on national television. They begged the governments to look into it. So we also have to wonder why the White House was calling the Malaysian government every single day. It's not because they cared about Philip Wood, the one American passenger on board this plane. They were calling because they were trying to set up a cover story. That's the reason why all the obfuscation. That's why when you remember back to it, you go, well, we were looking at the South China Sea, and then they say, well, now it turned over the peninsula of Malaysia, which that should have been obvious from the beginning if they had radar of that from their military radar. And then they say, okay, well, now it made another turn, flew over Penang, the closest airport that you would go to, and goes to the Nicobar Islands, and then makes a sharp turn into the South Indian Ocean. And that narrative came from United States intelligence sources, unnamed sources, on March 13th, March 14th, 2014. So in my mind, it's very clear they were trying to develop a cover story for something that happened that they didn't want the world to know about.
Who's on the plane? Anybody important? Any?
Yeah. Oh, yes. So, and the beauty is we don't even really need the MH370 videos to show that something crazy happened here. We've got 20 Freescale semiconductor scientists and engineers on board this plane. Far too many people for one plane to be out there. Like my company has had the rules, like only 2 to 3 people. And these are people with highly advanced technical knowledge. Now, the reason why these people are the motive is because when you look at advanced technology, the two major things that are at the cutting edge right now are plasma physics and semiconductors, superconductors, superconductivity. When you look at stuff like AI, quantum computers, they all use superconductive microchips. And these microchips are getting more and more advanced. They had just released a microchip that was smaller than the dimple in a golf ball. In fact, we found a Lockheed Martin patent for a coherent matter wave beam, which is pretty much exactly, it's a transducer, something that converts energy from one type to another. That's exactly what we need in order to create the type of anti-gravity effects that we are seeing in the MH370 videos. And that patent from Lockheed Martin was out in 2013. It's 10 microns in length. This thing is like the size of a bacteria. That's how small some of these things are. So when you look at this and you ask, why would you do this? Why this plane? Right away, you have to look at those Freescale semiconductor employees. 8 of them are Chinese nationals, 12 are Malaysian nationals. They're working for an American company. And the number one target for intellectual property espionage theft is actually foreign nationals that work for American companies. It costs the United States and American companies roughly $600 billion per year. So I think that there's two different scenarios that I think are plausible here. One is that somebody was on this plane that wanted to be rescued, a VIP, or however you want to look at it, and the United States intervened because they're the ones filming this. Or the other way that you could look at it is that this is a counter-espionage operation, that these people were going to China. They're going to Beijing from Kuala Lumpur. They were going to give China some very powerful intellectual property. And the United States said, no, we're going to go ahead and just, you know, have that plan blow up in your face. Metaphorically speaking.
Okay. We're going to take a break in just a couple of minutes and we'll get to what the film is that you have. But before we get there, tell me, how do you just dismiss the pings, the location pings?
Yeah, so I've looked at the satellite pigs myself, probably one of the only people that actually did. And when you get up to 1840, right before 1840, there's only two phone calls made to this airplane. One is at 1839, unanswered to the cockpit. Again, why would it be unanswered if we supposedly are trying to reach communication with them? And why would we not call them more often if they don't pick up? And then after that, there's only 10 rows of data. So before that, there's hundreds of rows of data. Looks normal. And after that, just 10 rows of data for this plane is supposedly going in the South Indian Ocean. There's a pattern change in the data. I talked to the experts from the independent group. Nobody can give me a logical explanation for why the data changes like this. So the difference between this plane ending in the Nicobar Islands and the South Indian Ocean is 10 rows of data on an Excel spreadsheet. And then they call again around 2313, 2315, and that's it. If you've got a rogue 777 going out there, it might be hijacked, what have you. Why would you not give it another phone call? And the real story of what happened to this plane is that there was a fire event related to 500 pounds of lithium ion batteries. Two stacks of it were in the forward cargo bay right next to the equipment center, the electronics bay. And there's 19 witnesses that support this. We have Mike McKay sees it on fire from his oil rig. 9 witnesses along the coast hear loud noises exact in time this fire starts. Fire suppression devices go off, put it out. You've got 8 fishermen on a boat who see the plane 10 minutes later. It's also been corroborated now that the plane did an emergency descent right after it turned around, consistent with what you do during a fire event to get more oxygen into the plane for the passengers. You're not going to kill them.
So before we get into this next segment, I want to make it really clear that I have no idea what's real or not anymore on some things. I have no idea what our government's capable of, not capable of. I have zero clue. This sounds so unbelievable. But I don't know all the technology. I don't know enough to be able to say this isn't true. But I'm also don't know enough to say it is true. It's Friday. I thought we'd have some fun by looking at something that I don't know, might be true, probably not, but could be. I know that Ashton Forbes has done his homework. He's an intelligent human being, and knows the science behind all of this, and may be right. I don't know. Ashton is with us. He told me half an hour ago, he kind of feels like every day he's like, I don't know. So we're about to show some video here, Ashton, of the plane and this is the main thing that you say needs to be looked at. Tell me about the video, what we're about to hear and see. And where we got the video.
Yeah, so this video has been on the internet since 2014. We've been able to trace it back to an account called Regicide Anon. The very first video, satellite video, says received March 12th, 2014, source protected. It was published May 19th, 2014. This is 9 days before the raw telemetry data, those satellite pings, were first available to the public. And that's why it's so important when we see those coordinates in the bottom left. The second video was supposedly received June 5th, 2014, published June 12th, 2014 on the same channel. Most people ignored this footage. A lot of people have said that they saw it back in 2014. I saw the drone video back in 2014. I ignored it like most people did. I think it's only in 2023, 2024 that we could even begin to understand that what we see there is potentially real, because science on the public side is slowly catching up. These private defense contractors, they know this stuff is real, and that's how far ahead they are from us. They are potentially 50 or 100 years beyond what the public might think is possible. We had a $150,000 bounty for the hoaxer to come forward with proof of their source work, because somebody didn't make these with just one shot. It would have taken lots of time and effort to put these together. There's not one discrepancy on a single frame in either video. No errors anywhere. The clouds actually do move and evolve in the satellite video. People don't think that they do because they don't realize how far away the satellites are potentially from the Earth and how each perspective is only a few seconds. The zap of the satellite video accurately illuminates the volumetric clouds in 3 dimensions. There's no reference copy to copy any of this from, which is a prerequisite for producing CGI. Because we have two videos from different perspectives that are perfectly in sync with one another, and you can see the same clouds and even triangulate the drone position, this would require a full 3D rendered environment using hardware and software from before 2014. This also predates all commercial AI as well as deepfake technology. So So if people think that you could recreate this, I guarantee you this is not some simple recreation in order to pull this off. Now, even more important than that, the details in the videos are scientifically accurate. What we're looking at here is something called macroscopic phase conjugation. It is essentially functionally equivalent to Star Trek warp drive. This is science that would be consistent with what Tesla had put forth and other people like Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Bearden in the 80s. The simplest thing that explanation I could give is that there is an extra dimension that we do not perceive that our reality is painted onto. We're going to bring back the term the ether, which is something that Tesla promoted. This is how we get the negative energy requirement that we need in order for a wormhole to exist. The macroscopic phase conjugation uses something called mixed wave interferometry. It's very similar to holography in terms of making a hologram. We have our three pump waves, which is our zero point system that we see with our orbs and creating that triangle formation. And then we have a fourth orb that we do not see on the screen here, which is essentially shooting a phase conjugate wave into that. And then it gets a perfectly reflected beam going back the other direction. So essentially we are creating a gravitational wave here through electromagnetics. And then we are having this plane slingshot, like pulling on a rubber band and letting go of one side from one location to another. So what I'm saying here is this is not aliens. This is our technology. I don't know where we got it. And I don't frankly really care. I think it could go as far back as 1943 in the Philadelphia experiment, maybe even the Manhattan Project. But what I want people to know is that Tesla was right. The event that we see in the thermal is an endothermic event. It's an absorption of energy. This is, again, consistent with what Thomas Bearden promoted in the 80s, talking about cold explosions, absorbing energy from one location and having it reappear somewhere else. This may even be the first endothermic event ever recorded, as far as I know.
Now, basically, what you're talking about is we're making a wormhole, right?
Yeah. And so this goes back to an idea that has been promoted by Einstein. Einstein, or ER equals EPR. Leonard Susskind and Juan Maldacena have promoted this, which is the idea that an Einstein-Rosen bridge, a wormhole, could be consistent with Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen, which is quantum entanglement. We know we can teleport quantum information.
Correct.
That's already been proven. But
yes,
the idea is, how do we do that on a macroscopic scale? Juan Maldacena has actually recently, in the last 4 years, promoted humanly traversable wormholes as well as papers. So the idea that you could go through a wormhole and you're not going to be ripped to shreds. In fact, we were just looking recently on my live streams, two different Defense Intelligence Agency papers, one called Warp Drive, Dark Energy, and Manipulation of Extra Dimensions, and the other one called Traversable Wormholes, Stargates, and Negative Energy. Both of these papers pretty much lay out exactly what we see in those videos. And the only thing that people are confused about is how do you get the negative energy requirement? Well, once you add the idea of the ether and we get rid of all this quantum fluctuations and virtual particles that physicists talk about now, that's just the ether with extra steps. So we just go back to the idea of having the ether. And if you have a high enough energy intensity, you break through the Schwinger limit. And now our kind of local space-time becomes nonlinear.
Okay.
And it's going to self-correct.
Okay. You're way over my head. I'm sure you're way over everybody else's head. But I wanted you to show you're not an idiot when it comes to science. Now, go back to the video. Let's show it. It's the blue video with the heat signature of the plane, which is that the satellite video?
No, that one's our drone video. So the satellite video is going to be the white and kind of blue one.
Okay.
And we believe this is happening at night, and it's, you know, false color IR
okay.
in the satellite. So, and in the drone video, it's thermal.
Okay, so we see in the thermal video, the drone video, we see one object, round object, coming to the plane and then kind of making a weird kind of path around the plane. Then two others come and they triangulate the plane and spin quickly around the center or the nose of the plane. I can't tell which.
So what they do right away is they're spinning around it in a spherical formation. This is clearly mapping the plane to some degree. My guess is what they're doing is they're trying to figure out how big the mouth of the wormhole needs to be to encompass the entire plane so they can produce the exact right amount of energy that's necessary. And then they actually reorient about halfway through, and then they begin to go vertical around the plane in a ring formation, which if you look at the right-hand rule in electrical engineering, you'll find that then the vector based on this would be backwards, which when this dark event happens, actually you can see we've overlaid it. The plane slightly moves backwards into this wormhole as well. So this is actually also consistent with electrical engineering principles.
Okay.
And I have to go ahead.
I'm sorry. We just have such little time, and I would urge people who want to know more to go to your website and follow this. But these three things open up, and then there's this like black blotch. It just looks like what is that? That's energy.
Yeah, so this is technically what we're looking at there is a cold event, an endothermic event, an absorption of energy. So I would argue that what we're looking at there is the mouth of the wormhole. And if you want to think of it in layman's terms, what you're thinking is you're ripping through the fabric of reality there. So if you think of our reality as a painting, you're ripping the painting off and you're looking at the underlying canvas there. And it's quickly closing up again right after.
Okay, so let me go to the other. It's like a black and white or black and blue and white kind of. You see the clouds, you see the plane coming in. This is secret. This is our satellite tracking system.
Yeah, so we don't look through satellites individually anymore. I mean, it's 2024, even in 2014. You know, we use ground-based computers, and then they can rebuild using the ground-based computers, the software, a tracking mechanism. And that's how we're able to look at it like this without seeing the satellite move.
Okay.
And then what I was going to say, in the thermal video too, there was heat signatures in the orbs as well, which is consistent with topological monopoles that was only publicly available from the Aalto University paper in 2015, a year after these videos as well. So the science that we see in here really wasn't even publicly available at the time when these videos were released and made public.
And all of a sudden in the second video, you see the flash and the plane just disappear. Now, this seems ridiculously unbelievable. You know what I mean? Because it's just, you don't see it. How could this possibly be true? But the science would show that it's possible if you play it out. But why would we do this?
Yeah. And then why cover it up? And what I would say is that we are potentially looking at the most secret classified super weapons in the United States military arsenal. We dropped the atomic bomb in 1945. That was 79 years ago. And people still think that nuclear weapons are the most powerful weapon we have. No, the military has figured out a unification theory of quantum field mechanics and general relativity. And now we have gravity manipulation and space-time manipulation. This type of weapon is unstoppable on this planet. Whoever has this technology controls the planet. This is why the cover-up. This is why they want us talking about social issues and nobody looking at what kind of advanced technology.
Why would we allow this to be? Why did we do this to this plane?
Yeah, and doing this to this plane, again, so you would say that the only logical explanation in my mind, this is a show of force. We wanted China and Russia to see this. We want to say, you're going to try to steal our guys that know how this technology works, the guys that make the microchips, potentially know the plasma physics, in this case, the microchip producers, that what we see in these orbs here, that's a plasma field around the orbs. If you look up hypersonic weapons, that's what you need to make a hypersonic weapon work so that they can move at the speeds at which they do, the plasma sheet around them. So within this is some smaller object, and I guarantee that there are very advanced microchips within that small object as well.
Okay.
And you could argue that those are the reasons why we're trying to do this, and they didn't expect these videos to leak, of course, but they would expect China and Russia to have their own satellites, and they would have some idea of, whoa, what did somebody just do to this plane? And this is like, hey, don't mess with us. If you try to do this again, we're going to zap you to wherever we need to.
All right.
But I agree, it's a huge risk to be filming this, and I think that we've only developed this warp drive technology based on the papers probably in the early to mid, maybe even late 2000s. So I don't think this was a test, but I also don't think that this technology has been out there for decades and decades. I think that to get it to this point is probably relatively recently, but that's a good question.
So I've only got about a minute left, and man, there's just so much to cover with you, but the last question is, who leaked this? How did we get this?
I'm glad we did that. So Edward C. Lin is the guy. If you look up his case, he took a plea deal to go into prison for 6 years on a 9-year sentence. His timeline of being the VPU-2 Wizard Squadron as a spy plane program is from February 2014, where he first gets investigated April 2nd, 2014. The defense argued the classified information and questions available on the internet. The VP squadron has deployments in Diego Garcia military base. The military was afraid that if this case went to trial, they would have to show what the information was that he leaked to damage national security so badly. I FOIA'd the NCIS, and they rejected my FOIA in total to be kept secret in the interest of national defense or foreign policy. And he was caught with flight manifests that include search and rescue code names as well. So if anyone disbelieves or whatever, we have absolute proof that if you just go talk to Edward C. Lynn, if we can get him to come forward and admit that he leaked these videos, if these videos are real, he's the guy. I gave this information to the AARO, the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. They responded back a couple weeks ago saying, Mr. Forbes, my apologies for the slow response. AARO is researching several topics. Some of AARO's initial research into MH370 has revealed the U.S. government search efforts after the airliner disappeared from radar. I believe the genesis and authenticity of the videos may be helpful. Can you confirm the date the videos were posted to the Regicide Anon YouTube channel? And yes, a quick follow-up call may be helpful. They've ghosted me since then. If these videos are real, they will be able to authenticate them.
Ashton, I honestly don't know what to think. But that's pretty much about everything right now. In some ways, I hope that you're right. All the people were most likely dead because of the fire, right? When this happened.
My approach, yeah, okay. It's not looking good. So I always like to give the condolences to the family. We've got a fire event, Boeing planes I don't trust at all. Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me if they spew toxic smoke when they start on fire and kill everybody. So even when we get to the zap, it's not looking great. So I don't want to give anybody false hope out there. What I do want to tell people is that if this is real, then free energy is real. And that will change our entire planet. If you imagine the implications of free energy, yeah, you can see why they would hide this. We have everything to gain from these videos and nothing to lose.
Yeah, that's really what caused the downfall of Tesla. He had free energy, I believe, and you can't put a meter on free energy, and that's the real problem. Money, always. Ashton, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the best of Glenn Beck. Check out the full show podcast to listen to the rest of this interview.
Cliff Sims, the author of Darkness Has Not Overcome and former special assistant to President Trump. And Cliff, I think right after the launch of GBTV, you were on, because I think you were You were involved with the Frederick Douglass something, and we were talking about that, were we not?
That's exactly right. First TV interview I ever did in my entire life. I was chairman of the Alabama College Republicans, and we had a Frederick Douglass Republicans push going on
right.
at the time. It coincided with what you were doing on the show, and you had me come on and talk about it. So a little wow. bit of a full circle moment here.
Yeah, that's cool. And now look at what you've accomplished. I'm still here. You went out and did things. Congratulations. Talk to me about a couple of things. First of all, what it was like being a part of the room and being a part of something as historic as moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Yeah, well, there's so many incredible stories around that topic, but the one that I remember the most is actually the day after the president made good on that promise, which, you know, we kind of take for granted now, but was a really kind of an unbelievable moment, given that Bush, Obama, I mean, go down the list of
everybody.
Presidents, Clinton, who had said they were going to do it and then they didn't.
Right.
That's right. And it kind of came this, you know, foregone conclusion. Oh, well, you promised to do that on the campaign trail, then you don't do it. Well, then we get in the room to start talking about it, and Trump's like, well, hold on just a second. We're doing this. Like, it wasn't a question. Like I said, I'm going to do it. We're going to do it. And so he follows through. And right
hang
after
on just a hang on just a second. What was the pushback from the State Department alone?
Well, the pushback from the State Department, pointy-headed experts over there,
yeah.
is really the same as what you heard from folks like Joe Biden, who said, you're going to bring the region to the brink of war. You're going to spark mass chaos in the region, and they paint these kind of crazy scenarios of what was going to happen. And right after the president did it, we walk out of the Oval, and we're in this part of the West Wing called the Outer Oval, right outside the Oval Office, and there's a TV on the wall, and where it's actually showing some of that chaos, some of the things that the protests happening, which frankly at this point look a lot like what we're seeing on college campuses around the country here in the United States. But as we're watching it, the president's kind of just, you know, watching it unfold. They're burning American flags. They're screaming, Trump, Trump, you will see, Palestine will be free, you know, things like that. And I had this weird sense that I can only compare to it's going to be kind of a strange comparison, but I think you'll get it. If you see someone trip on the sidewalk and you look away because you don't want them to see that you saw it happen because you feel this like kind of secondhand embarrassment for them, mm-hmm. it's not that the president had done anything wrong. Don't get me wrong. It's just when you're watching someone endure that type of criticism and hatred being directed at them, it's kind of an uncomfortable moment. The president's reaction, though, I will never forget. He watched it, and then he looked at me and he said, okay, what's next? Huh. As in, like, what's next on the schedule today? It did not faze him one bit, and it stuck with me because I think it's a core operating principle I try to apply to my life that anybody should apply to their life is you have to make peace with being misunderstood. The longer you're willing to be misunderstood, the bigger, more disruptive change you can deliver. And Trump was fearless and unafraid of the criticism, unafraid mm-hmm. of people saying his intentions were nefarious, whatever, if he felt like he was doing the right thing. And I gained a lot of respect for that because you just don't see that among politicians in America these
days. Yeah, I have to tell you, I may disagree with his tweets or whatever. I find him funny. I find him very funny. But I also really like him. I like him on what I have seen from him in real life, not in the media, not the showman, although, again, I enjoy the showman. But he is kind man that is who he is, knows who he is, and doesn't care about anything else. He doesn't care what people say.
No, I think that's right. And I've said it a million times and people ask me the same kind of thing. Oh my gosh, what's it like working for Trump and, you know, the tweets and other, whatever it may be. And I tell them, I'm just telling you right now, you cannot walk in a room with Donald Trump, no matter what your preconceived ideas are, and walk out not liking him.
Yeah.
He's going to make you feel like the most important person in the room. You're going to have fun. It's going to be funny. So I totally agree. Your experience much the same as mine.
And you always can tell the measure of a man by how they treat the lowest person in the room. When I was out at Mar-a-Lago and we were shooting something, you don't go to Mar-a-Lago, you know, looking like a bum. But, you know, we had the lighting people there that were just contractors and, you know, my staff was there and they were just going into this one room and then they were going to break down and go away. And so they weren't dressed like I was dressed. And Trump said to me after the deal, he said, what are you doing for dinner? And I said, I think we're probably going to McDonald's. And he said, tempting. Why don't you come have dinner with us at Mar-a-Lago? And I was like, okay. And I said, when and who? And it was just this awkward moment. He's like, no, everybody. I mean, he cares about the lowest person on the ladder, which somebody like at that level usually doesn't. You know, he introduces himself to everybody that can't affect him at all. And that means something.
The most famous person in the world going to introduce himself to someone when they walk up to him. No, that's right. And this is the side of him that you don't see in the media. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times at Mar-a-Lago I have seen with no cameras around. He'll see people that are working there in various capacities at the big events and things. And he'll walk up and take out his wallet and hand them $100 and say, great job tonight.
Yeah.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I agree with you.
So talk to me about, because you were assistant to the DNI, is that right?
I was deputy director of national intelligence, yes.
Okay. And that gives you access to all of the spy agencies and intelligence agencies.
That's right. So, yeah, the DNI oversees the 18 agencies, the alphabet soup of ATC, right. CIA, NSA, you name it, all right. of them. That's right.
So what was your takeaway from that? I know in your book you talk about walking in and seeing all over trans lives or human lives, and this is back in, what, 2016?
This was 2020, actually.
2020,
so it was the last part of the administration. Man, I had a lot of takeaways from it. On one hand, that job compared to my West Wing job where I was a communications aide, I enjoyed it more in some ways because I wasn't having to argue with the White House press corps all day about tweets and the other dumb things that they focus on all the time. So that was a benefit of it. I also gained an appreciation for, some of the real heroes that we have who are serving in those agencies, who are trying to protect the country. but also gained a more disturbing appreciation for the things that you mentioned, the power of the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Office in CIA, and how it basically bullies people into submission and is pushing these, social agendas. And you're right. The first time I walk into CIA, I will never forget turning a corner to walk into the cafeteria at CIA, and there's a giant Trans Lives or Human Lives poster hanging on the wall, and being struck by someone here took time out of their job, which is protecting the country, to hand make this poster and hang it here. Again, there are a lot of people in the IC who do just want to protect Americans' national security. Then you see things like, recently, a few months ago, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence published an op-ed internally by a current intelligence officer discussing how being a cross-dresser somehow makes him better at his job. The Biden administration has even made various DEI benchmarks one of their top goals in what's called the National Intelligence Strategy, which is our entire strategy on how we approach intelligence gathering and analysis in this country. It's one of their top goals. And even in the wake of the Chinese spy balloon traversing the continental United States, that same internal magazine from ODNI was devoted to, quote, the importance of words, like making sure no one's feelings are hurt by the word choices that analysts use when they're writing about the CCP. So this is the kind of stuff that, given the opportunity to come back in, when President Trump comes back in, I think he's going to have a real opportunity to put some leadership in place in those agencies, who will get their focus back where it needs to be, which is on American national security, protecting the American people, and China, number one, first and foremost, our real number one national security threat, not global warming, not a lack of DEI. China is where our focus needs to be, and it's going to be a big opportunity in the next administration.
So maybe we'll have you back on again, because I really want to go into the doomsday bunkers and what's in the nuclear football. It's all in your book. I want to ask you, why did you name the book The Darkness Has Not Overcome?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you for asking it. It comes from the Gospel of John 1:5. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. We're facing persecution and increasingly secular culture. Our politics still broken and divisive, and we should be fighting for what we believe. But we also shouldn't get discouraged, because the light will not be overcome. That's a promise that we can take to the bank. And this book is all about those stories that you're talking about right now, taking you into rooms that you couldn't see otherwise, wouldn't know what's going on in otherwise. But they also give a takeaway from each of those stories straight out of the Bible for how they could apply, lessons that could apply to anyone's life. And honestly, Glenn, part of me wanting to write the book was, I have a really difficult time in my own personal life sticking with a devotional. And so I basically wrote a book. It's not a devotional, but it has some elements of it that is like what I would want to read. Give me an amazing story from inside the halls of power, but then give me a biblical takeaway that can actually impact my life no matter what I'm doing.
And I love that. Cliff, I hope we get the chance to meet again in person and see each other again in person. I admire the effort on this book and what you're doing. And
thank you so much. Would love to come back on anytime.
You bet. Thank you. Cliff Sims. The name of the book is The Darkness Has Not Overcome. You know, today is a great day to get a warranty. Actually, any day is a great day when you're not worrying about your appliances and home systems. That's what you get with an American Home Shield warranty. All the unexpected breakdowns, like a leaky faucet or faulty water heater, they're not going to break the bank, because covered repairs and replacements are all taken care of. Having reassurance is something to celebrate. Choose the plan that works for you and your budget. When a covered item in your home breaks, all you do is contact American Home Shield. Their trusted, qualified pros will fix or replace it based on the coverage limits in your agreement. When it comes to protecting your appliances and home systems, don't worry. Be warranty. Go to ahs.com/Beck and save 20%. That's ahs.com/Beck and get 20% off any plan.
See ahs.com/contracts for coverage details, including limit amounts, fees, limitations, and exclusions. New Jersey residents, the product being offered is a service contract and is separate and distinct from any product or service warranty which may be provided by the home builder or manufacturer.